Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Today we have a very exciting program, and I want to apologize for not being with our listeners last week. We went through a time change, and unfortunately it affected the timing for our program, so when we were prepared to come on the air, we were uncertain exactly what time we were supposed to be on, and subsequently we had to reschedule that. So today we have Alan Mackey, and also he's a political analyst and social activist, and we have Stephen Katz. He is a New York State chair with the Socialist Party USA. They are both joining the program today, and thanks to both of you for coming on together on this very important subject that we will get into today.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Our subject today is we're going to be discussing the growing threat of another world war. And we can see that events that are taking place in Europe, they're escalating at an exponential pace. And what it is doing is not only creating a threat within that region of the globe, but it's also creating threats of a world war on a global scale. So today we're going to discuss a little bit about what is going on in that part of Eastern Europe so people can understand what it is. We've been seeing little bits and pieces over the news, but it is not getting into depth where people can really understand what is going on. And, of course, we can understand that is by intent. But first of all, to both of you, I want to ask this question. Crimea. And why is it important to the European Union and the United States, and why is it important to Russia, that part of the world? Either one of you can start with this, with our questioning today.
Well,
Alan? Stephen? Okay.
Crimea for Russia is their only war mortar port, and it represents an important outlet for trade and for energy, and it has historically been part of Russia, as has the Ukraine, going back many, many hundreds of years. And the majority of the people living there are Crimean. In the 1950s, I understand that when the Soviet Union was in existence, Khrushchev let it become part of the Soviet Republic of the Crimea, which, was more or less a pro forma thing because all of them were bound together in the Soviet Union. And now you have both geopolitical and geoeconomic considerations centered around the Ukraine, and there are a lot of fears that the in other words, there are a lot of there's a lot of competition, economic competition. Obviously, the EU wants to draw in the whole Ukraine, including the Crimea. And incidentally, Russia has a treaty with the Ukraine for the maintenance of the seaport at the Crimea, and they want to, but the EU wants to draw it within its boundaries and ultimately probably make the Ukraine part of NATO, and Russia, of course, does not want NATO on its borders and doesn't want a hostile regime on its borders. So that's, just some of the background, to the current conflict. I see it basically as a conflict between the Russian oligarchs and the Ukrainian oligarchs fighting over it, and the masses of people there have much more in common on both sides of the line. You know, as workers, than they do. And nationalism, which has been a terribly destructive force, and it was the cause of two world wars, as well as many, many other wars, you know, down through the centuries, is being used as a psychological manipulative device to try to gain an advantage there. So that's, you know, just some of the considerations. You know, and I'll stop, let Alan, you know,
well,
go ahead.
Well, Alan, Stephen mentioned geopolitical and geoeconomic.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, what's going on there is by accident. I think the United States has been instigating this whole fight there along with the European Union for a number of years, even before the demise of the Soviet Union. You know, we got to realize that after World War II, prior to World War II, Hitler had built up forces in the Ukraine. And after World War II, this country, the United States, actually helped bring some of these Ukrainian fascists that had sided with Hitler into this country and were training them, and kept sending them back and forth between the Ukraine and getting training here in the United States from the CIA to disrupt things in the Ukraine. So, you know, this has been going on for a long, long time, probably close to, 60 years now. And the United States has been preparing for this all along. You know, this has happened in country after country, whether it's the South Sudan or Yugoslavia mm-hmm. or Libya or Iraq. The United States has used these divisive tactics to divide people, and that's what they've done in the Ukraine. And now, you know, the reason they've done that is because they want the resources there, the gas and the oil.
Now, what are those resources?
Well, the major ones are gas and oil. But, you know, this is something the United States needs to keep its whole military-industrial complex in operation on these 800 foreign bases around the world. They need this gas and oil.
Right.
And that's what they're after. You know, they've been after oil and gas all over the world. I mean, that's what's going on in Afghanistan. It's about the oil pipelines that run crisscross across that country. And Ukraine has all kinds of, you know, gas pipelines and oil pipelines and the oil. In fact, there's been disputes about what oil companies are going to control the oil fields off the, you know, the coast there in Crimea and the Ukraine. And these oil companies have just been drooling over this for years, and they've been waiting to get their hands on this oil and the gas resources there. And I think this is the source of the whole problem. And they've used this nationalism to undermine the unity of the peoples. You know, we're not even hearing. There are still many people in the Ukraine and Crimea that, you know, support socialism. And, you know, they see socialism as a solution to the problems there, the unity of the working people. And we're not even hearing about those movements. And,
right.
You know, this isn't by accident.
This government that they have right now in Kiev, in Ukraine, is it a legitimate government, Alan, Stephen?
No, it's a fascist government, and, you know, the United States has installed that government. We've had politicians over there trying to disrupt things in Ukraine. John McCain has been over there. Then you have these two people with the Obama administration. I forget their names, but they've been undermining things. They've spent millions and millions of dollars undermining the Ukrainian government, just waiting to get their hands on this oil and gas. And, you know,
yeah,
some,
like around
some,
$4 billion.
Some groups are calling for their removal, and they're saying that, you know, supposedly they've, you know, worked against Obama, but, you know, we know that Obama has given them the orders to do what they've done. And outfits like the Progressive Democrats of America are calling for the ouster of these two people and for new replacements. But, you know, we're talking about a country, the United States, that's the major imperialist country in the world, and just switching people into different chairs isn't any solution to this crisis. And, you know, this is very serious. It could cause World War III.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Alan is saying, 100%. There was 80 NGOs, which were fronts for, you know, the CIA and Western financial interests to destabilize the Ukraine and put in these far right-wing extremists. There's no legitimate government there, and the Russians, of course, and many Ukrainians, I think, feel that they would do much better with Russia than they would with the EU, because they see what has happened to the countries in the EU that have been subjected to all these austerity programs, which is what they have planned for the Ukraine, to exploit cheap labor and to exploit the natural resources and, you know, the oil and gas that and the control of the pipelines and all of this. And I heard Galloway, the British member of parliament, a former member of parliament, and he made a very good point. He said that back in the days of these major Cold War, President Kennedy was willing to go to the brink of a nuclear exchange with Russia because there were missiles 90 miles offshore of the United States, and if the Ukraine joins NATO, there's not, you know, there's a lot less. I mean, there's just a thin border. It's right on the border. There's nothing even separating them.
Right.
And,
it's a matter of going crossing a line.
Yeah, I mean, it's just total hypocrisy for the United States to cite, or rather for the Obama administration to cite international law and the interference in sovereign states, where here you have a dangerous fascist regime which has seized power in the Ukraine and is right on the border of Russia, which has been invaded by fascist regimes before, as we know. And to say that that's an interference to Ukrainian sovereignty, and yet going thousands of miles away to invade Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and all that, that's not a violation of international law when there was no serious threat to the United States in any manner, shape, or form. So we know that the former constitutional law professor Obama knows less about constitutional law than any fifth-grade student in the United States, or he's just mouthing lies for the military-industrial people and corporate people.
In a statement that was issued by the White House said the voting in Crimea was administered under threats of violence and intimidation from a Russian military intervention.
That's a lie.
And that violated international law. You know, I wonder who, you know, we spew out all this stuff about international law and seem like these clowns don't even understand what international law is. Is this supported by any evidence that they violated, it was a violation, this election in Crimea was a violation of international law?
No, it's on the contrary. You know, the election was monitored by innumerable election monitors from different countries, and it was very peaceful. There was no interference with it, and the overwhelming majority of the population supports it. And, you know, I mean, they had no problem with Yugoslavia splitting up. They forced it to split up and recognize Kosovo, which really should be a part of Serbia. And that's okay over there, but based on, you know, ethnicity and unity of interest and culture, but it's no good in the Ukraine. So you know they're total hypocrites, and they're simply they simply use whatever arguments that they favor them at the moment, you know.
Alan?
Well, you know, it's, like I said, it's a very dangerous situation, and the American people are going to have to sort through these facts. We're at a point right now in this country, you know, I can remember during the 50s and 60s hearing my dad say, well, you know, I'm reading this, but I have to read between the lines to get at the truth, when he was reading a newspaper. Well, now the lies are coming so hot and heavy, you can't even read between the lines to get at the truth. You know, it's almost impossible to tell what's going on. You know, if you look at, read a newspaper article, you read USA Today or any of these newspapers, and you after you read the article, you wonder, what the heck is going on here? You know, you can't even figure it out. And that's part of the problem. They're just shoving so much misinformation down our throats, it's almost unbelievable. But they have to do this in order to prevent any opposition to imperialism. You know, years ago, Mark Twain recognized the first imperialist war, the Spanish-American War. And we haven't given the American people, we as the left, haven't given the American people the kind of anti-imperialist education that the working class in this country requires. And that's one of the main problems. We're not, people in this country are not able to see the difference between an imperialist war and a just war. Like World War II was a just war against Hitler. And Obama and these people try and create this facade that makes it look like every war that they go into is a just war. And you have these politicians and these think tanks talking about humanitarian wars. And, you know, we're going to be hearing more about that, I'm sure, as the situation goes on in the Ukraine. And, you know, how can you even talk about humanitarianism when you got outright fascist in power in the Ukraine right now? These are outright fascists, and there shouldn't be any misunderstanding about that. And, you know, how this country or any country in the world can take sides with these kinds of people is almost unbelievable, because it's, you know, World War II almost repeating itself again.
Well, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, there was also the policy of Joseph Goebbels during the time when the Nazis were in power in Germany. And we have come to understand that if you lie enough and it's repeated often enough, people will begin accepting it. And we can see by the laws, the lies that we receive daily from the news media, it's one lie after another. It's they're just throwing so much garbage at the public that people can't even sort through it, so they just accept it. Much of it is accepted on the face value. But I'm reading this information that was provided on the WSWS, and it says World Socialist website. It says, yeah, more than a decade ago, Washington officially adopted the policy of preemptive war banned under international law as a form of aggression, and maintains as a matter of state policy that it has the right to launch drones and kill people in any country without the permission of the government, a position that has top UN officials declaring illegal. Under Obama, assassination and mass killings by such means have been vastly expanded, taking thousands of lives, including those of American citizens, in a number of countries. But when you're talking about international law, Stephen and Alan, when we talk about international law, this country just tramples over international law. Borders of other countries don't mean anything to this government. What is your take on that, Alan?
Well, when we talk about international law, I mean Article 1, the first article in the United Nations Charter, you know, it stipulates that there's the right of people to self-determination.
Right.
And the people of Crimea have voted what they want to do. That is their self-determination. What gives Obama or anybody else or the European Union or even the Russians the right to tell the people of Crimea what to do? The people of Crimea have made a decision. They want no part of what's really at issue is that the people of Crimea want no part of capitalism. I don't think that they want to really go with the capitalist in Russia either, but they've got no choice at this point. It's either to be swept up by these fascists in the Ukraine and go to war with them, or to be protected by the Russians. That's what this amounts to. And I think that's, you know, the bottom line. The people of the Crimea have made a decision, and that should be honored and accepted by the peoples and the governments of the world.
And essentially what it creates is just a roadblock as far as for the interests of the EU and also the U.S. But their primary goal is still to be able to control that region. But, Stephen, what is your take on that?
Well, I mean, as I said, I agree with what Alan's been saying, and that the, you know, under the neocon theory, you know, international law is simply whatever the United States deems it is that would be in its interest. In other words, they define it. It's like two parties to a legal dispute where one party feels because of their superior strength and economic resources and everything else, they have the right to, in effect, instantaneously create laws that are in their favor and violate laws that are not in their favor. It goes back to Plato. When he was arguing against people who said, well, law, justice is the right of the stronger. And Plato argued, no, justice is not the right of the stronger. Justice is an idea which has a rational basis and can be understood rationally and should be applied that way. It's not the right of the stronger. And you know, as far as this is concerned, you know, we have dangerous elements here in the United States, and we've always had them, but they've become more and more dangerous over time. You know, the military, the CIA, and so on and so forth. I don't think Obama's in control of any of this. There's probably much more he could do against it, but he won't because he just doesn't have it in him to do it. And, you know, they are really in control of the policy. The defense budget is being cut, you know, and they would like nothing more than to whip up, you know, a new war so that the defense manufacturers can start sending more weapons to the Ukraine and
right.
The far-right Ukrainian forces. And, you know, creating, you know, more and more tensions. You know, so far, I mean, Obama has put some restrictions on some of the Russian elite. And Europe has been verbally saying things, but there's a lot more trade going on in Europe, between Europe and Russia, particularly Germany. And Putin and the Russians have a lot of economic leverage, so I don't think that this is if they want to start an economic war, I think they're going to end up on the negative end of it. And you know, best case scenario in terms of preventing this from escalating into a larger and larger conflict is that, you know, the war of words dies down, the Crimea becomes part of Russia. You still got a big problem in eastern Ukraine, in the Donetsk region there, with all the industry, and there's a big Russian population over there. And, you know, maybe they'll be granted not complete reunification, but some greater
right.
amount of autonomy. And, you know, there is ways to work this out, and it's a big mistake to treat Russia the way Yugoslavia was treated and Libya was treated, because the Russians can match both Europe and the U.S. military machine punch for punch, I can assure you. Because Putin has rebuilt the Russian military in the past 10 years.
Well, I just want to get both of your takes on this. This is from the same article that I was reading. In the Ukraine crisis, it is the U.S. and the European allies that are the aggressors. They have intervened in order to dramatically alter the balance of force in the region to the disadvantage of Russia. They seek to turn Ukraine into a forward staging post for U.S. and NATO military forces, an endless provocation aimed at weakening and ultimately dismembering Russia. What is both of your takes on that statement?
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth in that. That you know, the United States expected to take over Russia, all the holdings and everything, the industry, as soon as Gorbachev came to power. And that's what they really anticipated, that American industry was going to be able to walk into Russia and take over everything. They did take over a lot.
Just by introducing capitalism, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, we don't understand that in Ukraine, that World War II, for the most part, ended with the defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945. But the World War II in Ukraine didn't actually end until 1954. You know, people don't understand this. All these fascist forces that Hitler had trained and that had even been fascist before Hitler rose to power were active in Ukraine, and these forces kept on fighting until they were smashed in 1954. So, you know, you had from 1945 to 1954, these fascist forces operating more or less openly in the Ukraine, and the Soviets had to put them down. And the United States was encouraging that all the time. I mean, there are records of the CIA being involved in the Ukraine in 1951, encouraging the assassination of Russian soldiers and Russians that have come into the Ukraine to build up the industry and everything. You know, there were tremendous investments made in by the Soviets in, you know, by building factories and the industries all throughout the Ukraine. So, you know, what did the United States build there? Nothing. And the people lived in peace and friendship all throughout, you know, from 1954 on. There was the people lived relatively peacefully there in Ukraine without any violence, only because the fascists had to constantly be put down and kept quiet. And, you know, we treated those people as fascists. We've always treated them as so-called freedom fighters. And there's a guy that was the head of the CIA unit that helped to bring these people into these Ukrainian fascists into this country, a guy named Herbert Rahmerstein. And Rahmerstein helped to give these people new identities and to live here in the United States. Many of their sons and daughters have now gone back to the Ukraine. Some of them have even run for office over there. And these are outright fascists that have been trained right here in the United States. And, mm-hmm. you know, you can't have a stable government with these kinds of people running around loose promoting the kind of hate that's being promoted. And, you know, to suggest that the Ukraine should be affiliated with the European Union after all these years, I mean, this is just totally ridiculous. The people,
yeah,
the majority of people want nothing to do with that.
Right. Stephen?
Yeah, I remember going back into the 50s that the U.S. was whipping up Ukrainian nationalism, but they used to whip up nationalism in any republic of the Soviet Union they could find because, you know, their aim was to weaken the Soviet Union domestically. You know, it is true that... you know, that they've promoted these forces there with the ultimate, I think, the ultimate aim of dismembering Russia. Now, when Yeltsin came in, I mean, Gorbachev, you know, gave the initial opening. And then when Yeltsin came in, you know, that's when, you know, generations of Soviet workers under the Soviet socialist system, which I would call a deformed system after the days of Lenin and Trotsky. But they still built up all those industries, and they just ripped it off and stole it from the people. And the U.S., you know, was coming in there to try to rip off whatever it could. And that's why Putin came into power. Putin came into power. He was put into power when they realized that the country was, you know, in a serious jeopardy, you know, between life expectancy, unemployment, and everything else that had gone on once Yeltsin got into power and, you know, all the new oligarchs. And then Putin came in, and Putin's mission was to try to rebuild the country and to protect the people there. Now, there are still oligarchs over there, even though Putin has, even the Putin regime has cracked down on the worst excesses of them. But the ultimate aim of the U.S. is to dismember Russia as Yugoslavia was dismembered.
Right.
Only, you know, it's two different orders of force that you're dealing with. They're not going to be able to do that with Russia, and they're not going to be able to push Putin around. And, you know, no matter what they try to do, you know, he's not going to be intimidated by them.
And we're going to talk a little bit about that type of intimidation and threats that the Obama administration that they're making at this time. But just for a very brief pause, I just want to mention that we have joining us on the Socialist Insight is Alan Mackey. He's a political analyst and social activist, and we have Stephen Katz. He is a New York State chair with the Socialist Party USA. And today we're discussing the growing threat of another world war. And what we have been covering is the crisis that has taken place in Crimea and what has taken place there in the Ukraine, and obviously it has global implications. This week we will be talking about the regional implications. And next week we'll move to the global. And once again, I'd like to thank both of you for joining the program today.
Thank you, Stu.
Thanks for having us.
Alan, I would just like to, you know, I want both of you to respond to this, but obviously we have President Obama. He's coming out with all of his threats. He's issued, you know, that he has made statements that they're going to pursue sanctions against Russia. I look at sanctions as an act of war, but threats of sanctions freezing the assets of the country. But what right does the U.S. have to take such measures, considering that they have done basically what we see happening there in the U.S., in the Ukraine? No one has issued these types of threats against the U.S., and what we have done is tenfold. But what effects can this president have in regards to issuing sanctions, and what particular impact can this have on Russia? And, Alan, could we start with you, and then we'll pick up with Stephen on that?
Well, I think that sanctions are an act of war, especially in this situation. But sanctions aren't going to work against Russia. There's no way sanctions are going to work against Russia. There's not a country in the world that's presently trading with the Russians that will stop trading with them because Obama tells them to. They can't afford
right.
to. And that's the bottom line. And, you know, these I forgot their name. I think it's something like Kagan, and then his wife has a different name, like Nowland or Newland or something like that. Anyways,
Newland.
These two people that worked for Obama, they did work for Dick Cheney. Now they work for Obama, and, you know, they were over there plotting to foment all this street activity and everything on the part of these fascists. And, you know, if you look at the demands of these fascists, what are they? Are they demands for reforms, for a better life for people? No. You know, they say they want to go with the European Union. Well, what does the European Union have to offer the Ukrainian people except for austerity, like Steve mentioned before? You know, you have to look at Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and see what kind of lives these the working people in those countries are living now. And we know that this country, the United States, wants to punish the people of the former socialist countries because they had socialism. They want to punish these people, and that's what they did with Russia. the transition to capitalism didn't have to be anywhere anything like it took place. Violent mobsters have come to power in Russia, and you've got these mobsters in power in Ukraine. They're even worse than the mobsters in Russia because they're outright fascist. And how does any kind of normalcy return to any of these countries now with this all going on? It's almost impossible. You know, we're on the verge of war. I don't think there's any doubt about it. The Russians can't tolerate what the United States is doing over there. There's no way that the Russian people will tolerate it. You know, that's why they maintained a strong defense under the Soviet times, because the Russian people considered the United States a threat. And the Russian people still view the United States as the most threatening country in the world, like most of the peoples of the world. So, you know,
well, any president that can issue an order to shoot drones across international borders, that's a threat. I mean, you can take out leaders of various countries, where you can create acts of war anywhere around the world, that is a menacing state, and that's where the U.S. is today.
The people in this area of the world.
It's a lot worse than people realize here. It's much, much worse. We're talking about a fascist regime in the Ukraine. We literally have a fascist regime in the United States, I have to say, at this point. And it's only going to get worse unless the masses of people become more active against it. It's only going to become worse. There is now, so far as what we have here, the sanctions that are being put on Russia right now, it's just a handful of their top leaders that are, their assets and travel is being interfered with. And, a couple of the top leaders there. And, then they say they're going to go ahead. But like I say, the Europeans are going to be very leery, because if Russia starts reciprocating with sanctions, the Russians can do a lot of damage to the EU economy, which is already teetering on the brink of total collapse. And the U.S. economy... is also not in very good shape. The unemployment is extremely high, and when the Fed stops pumping money into the stock market via the banks, could be very similar. So, I mean, there's no cards over there. I mean, there's no cards here that can be played against Russia. And the Europeans are not going to go along with extensive sanctions, because they can't survive. They need Russian energy. They need Russian trade. They can't. They're literally, you've got unemployment close to 50% in Spain, particularly among the younger people. I mean,
right.
I mean, well, what the hell are they talking about over there? Germany, I think has like a 30%, amount of trade with Russia. And the German economic oligarchs, if you want to call them that, or their economic elite, has a lot of their wealth is dependent on trade with Russia and all this. So I don't think this is going to do anything. McCain... who's a warmonger from way back. I mean, he's just, running around, but he's one person. But, again, there are very dangerous elements in the United States. The defense industry, and the corporations and so on that control our state can push it more and more into a military confrontation. Like Alan says, it's going to be shown pretty soon and very quickly that these economic measures are not going to do anything. So unless they're not going to do anything, they're not going to do anything to Russia, and Europe is not going to join in a severe thing. So the next step that'll be argued here is they're going to start pushing for military. You can't. McCain is already sending, stating to send weapons to the Ukrainian fascists, and also they've already sent AWACS and other things to Poland. And what's his name? McCain is insane enough to suggest that the F-16s in Poland be armed with nuclear weapons. I mean, he's talking, but there's a lot of people in the defense establishment that see dollar signs. And that's what's
right.
behind a lot of this talk, dollar signs. And what better way... go ahead.
What better way what?
I said, what better way to stop the cutting of the military budget in the United States, but to start some major conflict over in on the borders of Russia?
You know, I'm looking at once this regime change took place a few weeks ago, and the opposition took over in Kiev. First six steps that they did, which was very menacing. The first steps the Westerners took after seizing power were a declaration of wishing entrance into NATO, attacks on the use of the Russian language,
right.
a plea to be accepted in the EU, a refusal of Russia to continue to have a Navy base in Sebastopol, the appointment of corrupt tycoons as governors in the East and South
right.
Ukraine. So
right.
this this was like reading Russia the Riot Act. you know, here's a line. In other words, we're just going to put another line in the sand here. So,
well, actually, it's an attempt to provoke.
Right, exactly. It's very
right.
it's an attempt to provoke
conflict, because if you wanted to make certain gains but not provoke conflict, it obviously would have been phrased and done much differently.
I mean, here one of you mentioned, I think it was, one of you mentioned about their naval base. It's like, I'm just a few miles away from the naval base here in San Diego, which is one of the largest naval bases here. It
right.
is the largest naval base on the West Coast. But here some countries say, well, we're going to take over your complete naval base there in San Diego. The U.S. was like, we're not going to hear of this. You know, you're going to take, we got destroyers and we got carriers, and this is a major base for the U.S. But here this new regime come in and say, well, we're just going to shut down your operations there to that warm water port. So this was basically, another, as we mentioned about sanctions, it was an act of war. But, Alan, what is your comment on that?
Well, I agree completely that it's an act of war. I've lived in Virginia Beach for a long time, and if you look at the naval base there, if any country tried to take over that naval base, this country would consider it an act of war. If somebody just said, we want to do that, and they didn't even do anything, this country would consider that an act of war.
You know,
we saw what happened when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And I don't think any country, capitalist or socialist or whatever, is going to stand for their bases to just be taken over. And, this country has over 800 military bases around the world. And those bases don't belong in those countries in the first place. The base in the Ukraine, the naval base there, was placed there by joint agreement under Soviet times. And it was there for a specific purpose, to stop fascism from ever occurring again. And, the Soviet people, no matter what anybody thinks of the present Soviet government, I don't think much of Putin or these so-called leaders in Russia right now. But the Soviet people themselves, they know what fascism brings, and they know about war, and they don't want it. And they're going to, back their government and making sure the United States doesn't carry through their plans to try and take over, that naval base in the Ukraine. And, any country would do that. It's legitimately the Russians' naval base, It's not for these fascists to say that any European countries or the United States through NATO should now have that base. And, I mean, that's really what we're looking at. Obama expects NATO to obtain a free military base out of this, and
right
on the borders of the of Russia. And this is something that the Russians will never stand for. People are fools if they think the Russians are going to stand for this. They won't.
Right. Stephen?
Yes, I agree with that. And it begins, it also begins to make you question the competency of the people here, even from their, you know, the elite in this country, even from their own perspective, to do so, to proceed the way they are now, shows a tremendous ignorance of history and psychology and culture and all that goes along with that in dealing with these kind of situations. So the only answer there is that, you know, there are very dangerous elements in this, in the American state, that in the name of their own money and in the name of what they perceive as national security are capable of doing anything. And I say that, I mean, it's been 50 years since the JFK assassination, and I've been doing some research on my own recently on new evidence that has emerged, and you wouldn't believe the forces that were behind that, including the CIA. And now new evidence has come out and new testimony which proves beyond a reasonable doubt the involvement of elements of our own government and the use of the mafia. It is just beyond belief. And
right.
If they were willing to do that to do what they were doing to try to undermine and invade Cuba at that time and intervene there and other places, God knows what they will do today, in a manner of speaking, with all this that's going on, including the assassination of American citizens by drones. It's being done overseas pretty soon. It'll be extended here. And incidentally, evidence has come out in reference to witnesses to the JFK assassination that the CIA was involved in the elimination of some of the witnesses who had evidence of their complicity and involvement in the
right.
in the assassination, because Kennedy at that time was preparing to withdraw forces from Vietnam. He did not
right.
back the Bay of Pigs invasion. He did not invade Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And just about a month before he was assassinated, he had an ambassador, he had a diplomatic contact with the Cuban government seeking some kind of, like, detente with them and some sort of thawing of relationships. And this goes back to 1963.
I want to ask you, Stephen, Obama learned from the has he learned from history by looking at JFK that, you know, instead of going against establishment, you just go along with the program? And,
well, I don't know. I mean, it's impossible to know what goes on in his mind. But he got where he is
everything that he promised in 2007 and 2008, Alan, has he delivered on anything?
The only thing he's delivered on is his promise to reestablish U.S. imperialism as a very strong force in the world. He wrote an article
he's done a good
in
job
Foreign
of
Affairs
that.
Magazine. Yeah, he wrote an article in Foreign Affairs Magazine in 2007 where he said he wanted to restore America's dominance in the world. I mean, I don't think that Obama has any other objective other than what Wall Street's objectives are, and he never has. And I think that, you know, his mind is set that in such a way that he knows he's working for Wall Street, and that's exactly what he's going to do, whatever Wall Street wants done. You know,
military-industrial complex.
Exactly. That's a big part of Wall Street.
He's basically, although because of the way he was elected and the base of the Democratic Party, He has to make certain cosmetic gestures. He's just basically carrying on the same regime that we've had for years and years and years under Bush, under Reagan, under Carter, you know, going way back.
Exactly.
Going way back.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I have her on 9 minutes to cram a lot of stuff within that short period of time.
Yeah.
And I just want to mention once again, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining us, political analyst, and we also have Stephen Katz. He's a New York State chair with the Socialist Party USA and also an attorney there in
right.
the state of New York, joining us to discuss the growing threat of another world war. And once again, I want to thank both of you. Before we end the program, I want to have contact information from both of you. But just a couple of things I want to cover very quickly. A lot of people from time to time when I bring up these subjects, and they think I'm siding with Vladimir Putin, which I'm not. I'm not siding with the U.S. because I believe that, you know, both there's two wrongs there, and that doesn't make one right. But when you look at in the political scheme of things and you look at, you know, the U.S. is not going to stop from being an aggressive superpower. You're not going to have Russia is going to let another country just come in and park themselves right on their border. But how does, as socialists, how do we take a position as far as who's right and who's wrong? Because we can't just say, well, you know, that Putin should not have anything to do with Crimea or the Ukraine, and all of a sudden NATO is going to move forward and they're going to park their missiles right outside their borders, as we just mentioned. But how do you determine a pathway where you start moving toward peace? Alan?
Well, I think that we, first of all, we have to take an anti-imperialist position as socialists. And I think that's the most important, that we have to recognize what imperialism is and oppose it. On the other hand, the reality is we don't have to be supporters of Putin. We just have to realize what Putin and the Russian government are capable of doing as a major capitalist power now. That you know, the United States created this Russia as a major capitalist power and helping to get rid of socialism. So now you have this huge capitalist power in Russia that's an imperialist country of its own. And, you know, we should be working with the peoples of the Ukraine and Crimea and Russia who have common interests with working people here in this country. Hopefully, as there's a struggle for peace that begins to take place, you know, Putin's government will collapse, and hopefully this government here in this country will begin to collapse. And that's what we got to seek. We got to seek to bring, you know, people to power in this country, working people. We have to recognize that Wall Street and this military-industrial complex, these are our enemies, just like they're the enemies of the Russian people and the people of Crimea and the Ukraine. But we also have to understand that what's going on in the Ukraine, you know, they've under the guise of freedom fighters, these fascists, they've outlawed political parties. They've burned down and looted the homes of former politicians from the Soviet era and from the immediate past. You know, these are acts of fascists. These are people that do not want to engage in any kind of democratic decision-making, that they want to rule with brutal force. And you know, this is what fascists do. And I think what's going to happen in the Ukraine, we're going to see some kind of big civil war between the people that want peace and a legitimate say in their government and these fascists, you know, similar to what's going on in many other countries in the world today. And this is a dangerous, dangerous situation, because in these other countries around the world, you don't have major superpowers like Russia waiting and defending. They have to defend their interests. There's no two ways about it. They're going to, whether we support that or not. Putin is going to defend Russia's capitalist interest at this point. And,
right.
You know, that's what the American people got to understand. And this is the danger of what's going to lead to war. Obama is pushing a policy that's just totally wrong. The EU is pushing a policy that's totally wrong. And it's they're going to confront, you know, the Russians and one way or another. And, you know, who knows what can happen. Just a little spark can set off a world war. That's what happened in World War I and World War II.
Absolutely right.
Stephen?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we shouldn't neglect to mention that the classical symptom of fascism, which is anti-Semitism, has also been very much in evidence in the Ukraine as part of what has been going on. And also the fact that I'll go back and say, all right, so what is the position? Well, I would go back to what Lenin said during World War II, is that, you know, workers in all these countries should work for the defeat of their own ruling capitalists and oligarchs, and have an international socialist revolution and overthrow all these guys. But as a practical matter right now, you know, it's just like when Russia was attacked and Stalin was leading the Russian, deformed Russian socialist state. Even Trotsky, who hated Stalin as much as anybody, stated that the defense of the Russian socialist society, even deformed as it was extremely important. And that, you know, the fascists had to be fought and the Soviet Union had to be supported. Now, the Soviet Union is no longer a socialist state or even a deformed socialist state, but I would say that in a certain respect, if he is fighting the fascists in the Ukraine, I would rather see him be victorious over them. Just like I was very happy to read in history that Joseph Stalin was successful in leading the Red Army to crush the Hitler and the German fascists. Not because I like Stalin, because I happen to be a Trotskyist, but because he helped defeat, and the Red Army delivered the real knockout blow against the fascist army. And as much as I have problems with him, I'm not going to say that's a bad thing and a plague on both your houses. No. And there's people in the Socialist Party, our own party here, Stuart, that disagree with my position. But my position is, you know what? I'm a Jew in the Ukraine, and I'm being threatened with annihilation and pogroms and all kinds of stuff. You're damn straight I'll be happy for Putin to come in and send some military in there to protect me.
Well, the thing is, hey, you gotta love him.
And I don't care who,
you know,
I don't care who doesn't like it.
I'm not taking any.
I support Putin.
I stand on the side of working people, and basically we need to have a workers' revolution, because the workers of the world do not support what's going on with Russia, the U.S., or the EU.
I know, but
and when you look at those superpowers, they are the minority.
If someone is putting a gun to your head, the guy who's going to knock that gun out of that guy's hand, I'm for that guy for that action.
I have 2 minutes. Ellen, could you give me your contact information and Stephen, and then we're going to wrap it up. I think both of you. Ellen?
Sure. People can contact me by calling me at 218-386-2432, or they can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and you'll come across my Podunk blog, and all my contact information is there.
Alan, we always appreciate you on the program. And Stephen?
Yeah, I can be I can be reached through Facebook, and also I can be reached at the Socialist Party National Office at 339 Lafayette Street.
And I want to thank both of you for joining the program today. We'll be back on next week. We're going to pick up this where we're leaving off today. We're going to be talking a little bit about the UN. Is it a democratic body? We're going to be talking about what the U.S. is doing in other parts of the world when they're calling the acts of the Russians illegal. So anyway, I want to thank our listeners. thank our guests for joining our program today.
Thank you.
We'll be looking forward to having you to continue with
thank
us
you.
Next week on the Socialist Insight. And thank
defeat
you, Ruthann.
Fascism.
Have a good night,
defeat
everyone.
Defeat fascism all over the world. Defeat fascism.
Yep, thanks for having
thanks
us.
Thanks again.
Stuart.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Night.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, party people, and welcome to Dialectics. This is Nikolai Brown. This week I got on Zach Brown. He's the editor of antiimperialism.com, one of my favorite websites. But before we get to that, we'll go over some updates from that website. We have a critique of Albert Metzer's Exposé of the Vanguard Party. Definitely want to check that out. There's also a really interesting article about ableism and the need to build solidarity and support for proletarian revolution amongst patients, amongst people who are marginalized within first world societies. And there's also a new kind of strategy document called Behind Enemy Lines. That's all at antiimperialism.com. Also, at revolutionaryecology.com, what we got this week? The Idaho Ag Gag Law reveals class nature of the state. I don't know if people have heard about this, and we won't talk about it too much today. We're going to go into some news, but Idaho passed this Ag Gag Law, basically makes it illegal to videotape inside of factory farms. And I've been a vegetarian and vegan for a long time, and I was always one of those type of people that didn't need to see the videos of the factory farms. But, you know, I think it's important work that you know, it's not overthrowing the system, of course, but you know, I have mad respect for people who are able to go into factory farms and videotape that shit and, you know, bring that abuse to the light of day. Now, going into the show, we got Zach Brown on the line. You there with us?
Yeah, what's up, Nick?
How's it going, man?
Hey, dude. Sounds like we're going to be talking about some fantastic stuff tonight.
Yeah, well, I was hoping we'd go over some news. There's a lot of stuff happening in the world this week. It's, you know, a lot of continuation of what's been going on the last past weeks, of course. But,
right.
You know, we'll just go right into it. You know, normally whenever we go over the news, I mean, I normally just kind of read off the headlines from Democracy Now and give my own kind of commentary. But the first thing I wanted to go into, and I don't know if this is on there, but that recent NASA report that kind of described how...
Yeah, I saw that.
You know, civilizational collapse. Basically due to two reasons. First, because of increasing inequality, and secondly, because of increased resource strain, increased use and consumption of finite resources. And basically arguing that this is going to lead to a kind of society-wide sort of collapse. I thought it was pretty interesting. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. I actually had time to sit down and read the abstract and get some other opinions. There was a lot of different reviews, I guess you could say, of the study circulating around from people. You know, I think Forbes even did a small editorial or someone related to Forbes about how bogus it was. I mean, as you would expect. So there's a lot of different opinions that have been circulating on the study. I think it's very interesting, but at the same time, I think it's kind of like kind of stating the obvious, if you would, in a very a much more articulate way than perhaps you or I could, Nick. But I think the obvious point being is that the world, the finite world that we exist on, cannot sustain this kind of infinite growth that's constantly being projected. You know, that capitalism requires constant compounded growth, and that's just simply not possible when we live on a finite world with limited resources.
Definitely, definitely. And it was kind of interesting. I think we had talked about it a little bit on Facebook, and I kind of paraphrased, gave it the headline that NASA stopped short of paraphrasing the Communist Manifesto, and kind of
right.
there's a line in the Communist Manifesto about the possibility of the common ruin of all contending classes. Marx is kind of stating that if there's not a revolution, if there's not a clear resolution to the contradictions in society, that you could have something like this happen. what he called the common ruin of all contending classes. And NASA obviously wasn't basing their findings off of, you know, the rhetoric of the Communist Manifesto or anything like that, but they were definitely looking at the past histories of previous civilizations. And I think it's kind of interesting that today we live in a really a global civilization. There is one society, so to speak. So, you know, it's the first time in history, perhaps, that if you were to have this sort of collapse of civilization, it would have worldwide ramifications.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot different than if you consider, for example, the collapse of the Mayan civilization. You know, the collapse of the Mayan civilization did not mean anything for the collapse of adjacent native civilizations or even, you know, larger civilizations within Europe. I mean, but now you think about the interconnectedness of the world market. I mean, think about the interconnectedness of the world market today compared to just 20 years ago. I mean, the market is significantly more corporatized. They were warning about the threat of neoliberalism and this neoliberal globalization in the 90s. I mean, we're past that point now, you know? And so this idea of a worldwide civilizational collapse, I mean, that's a real possibility, but we also have to take the threat of that perhaps more seriously than we did before, you know, with the great consequences that would have.
Well, certainly. I mean, in both regards, of course, the consequences are going to produce social upheaval, and, you know, the potential for worse consequences are a reason for social upheaval. I mean, we need to really stem the causes, so to speak, you know, the capitalism, of course, as soon as possible, rather than, you know, wait till, you know, millions of people are displaced from rising sea levels, for example.
Right.
So when you know, and it definitely changes the world dynamic a little bit. I mean, this is the kind of, and I don't want to make it seem like it's going to be like a global catastrophe, but, you know, if you live in Bangladesh, like, it's a pretty big fucking deal. And it's gonna have a huge ramification for, you know, millions of people just in Southeast Asia alone. And how that's going to play out when it comes to political movements, I think, is going to be an interesting question. I guarantee you the U.S. military, for example, and intelligence services and everything like this are studying this question as well and kind of trying to come to grips about what sort of social movements are going to be produced by these ecological changes and how can they be contained. And, of course, ours is, you know, we want to do the opposite thing. What kind of social movements are going to be produced and how can we exacerbate them and push them towards revolution? But it's definitely something to think about. It's really interesting that NASA came out with that study too. It obviously is a department of the U.S. government. It's really kind of like a third-tier department anymore. Definitely not the height of prestige that it used to have.
But
cut and everything like that. But
then again, you even see a few of the central researchers there were from universities that aren't too unfamiliar. I mean, these universities are obviously ideological establishments of the hegemony of imperialist ideology, but at the same time you see this kind of perhaps even a sort of a contradiction brewing between the imperialists, between the monopoly capital and their allies over this question, because you see the more conscious elements in certain parts of the intelligence of the academic, I guess you could say, the academic strata, becoming more conscious of this threat that this program has, that this program of growth has upon the world, specifically upon their status within the world. I mean, you can't be a privileged, I suppose you can't be a privileged exploiter if you're dead. So,
certainly,
you know, there's definitely going to be a brewing contradiction.
Well, and there's another saying, you know, if you think money is so great, try, if you think the environment doesn't matter, try breathing money. I think that's an interesting point, that some of these environmental problems will and are kind of creating increasing awareness about the problems of capitalism. So we are kind of entering that a period of renewed struggle, even though it might not look like it now, but we are a period of renewed struggle against capitalism itself. And then on the other hand, I guess the big danger, so to speak, is that, you know, the capitalists kind of wise up. And I kind of think that's part of why this NASA report was released. It's like
they have long-term interests as well, and their long-term interest is to stay in power. So they're trying to figure, I mean, and I don't think like the imperialists or whatever are going to be able to will, you know, more equality into the world. It kind of goes against the central dynamic of capitalist imperialism, but they nonetheless realize that increasing inequality is going to become a threat to the overall system. So how can they mitigate that, you know, is a big question for them. So in order to mitigate that, they need to recognize that there is increasing inequality. They can't just be complete ideologues.
Right. So this offers a very unique conjuncture for organizations like RAIM, the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist Movement, and other communist organizations within the United States and within the world, is that, you know, previously, if you think about previous centuries, if you think about previous conjunctures where these sorts of crises, obviously not as serious as a worldwide collapse, but, I mean, you think of the crisis of overaccumulation in Europe. I mean, they solved that through capital exports, through the advent and the systemization of imperialism. The problem is that you can't really do that anymore. I mean, it's not like we're going to go imperialize or export capital to Mars or anything, but because, for one, that's not possible, and for two, that's not the primary contradiction here. You see this contradiction between the bourgeoisie, between monopoly capital and, you know, other forms of capital going to build, and you're going to see organizations, I hope at least, try to capitalize upon that, about how can we, because the answer that's going to be put forward is we just simply need to reform the system. You know, we need to mitigate these risks. We need to reform, essentially, right? But our mission should be to, how do we reorient this towards actually challenging the social order in the contemporary? How do we actually have an actual social transformation beyond, you know, reform, beyond simply mitigating this growing inequality?
Yeah, certainly, and kind of how to get beyond, I mean, you have these contending blocks of capital and the need to kind of build a real revolutionary movement that's based on, you know, the interests and the movement of the people themselves. Definitely. And I guess this kind of segues into the next kind of topic. I don't know if you got a chance to read this. This was on Systemic Capital like a week or two ago. But I've been following this, I don't want to say too closely because I don't know a whole lot about the whole situation. But NUMSA, one of the main trade unions in South Africa, it's the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, has essentially broken away, split from the alliance between the South African Communist Party and the ANC. And it's been a big deal because they're talking about forming they're calling it the Socialist Party, which I think is, you know, kind of a misnomer, so to speak. But nonetheless, right, they are kind of moving in a more popular sort of revolutionary way, and they are talking about the need to confront capitalism itself and rather just kind of dance around the issue. You know, they've kind of been highly critical of the South African Communist Party for basically playing a governing role, you know, kind of comprador role within the neoliberal world market. So this is pretty interesting, too. So we're seeing this heightened class struggle around the world. And they've specifically mentioned the ecological issues as well, which is really awesome that you know, more and more people are coming to recognize that this is an issue within the capitalist system. You know, whether it's, you know, exploiters at NASA or, you know, trade unionists in South Africa.
You really can't speak of any more of a naked example of brutality than that of which South African miners would experience. You know, I was actually, I don't know if you remember, but not too long ago, there was a massacre of striking South African miners. And I can't remember what the struggle for wages was about, but I remember it was something or another of like a $30 difference or something. I mean, something that perhaps in you know, a more privileged area of the world you would find perhaps rather trivial, but to there, I mean, it's life and death, and you see this kind of heightening class consciousness. And this is actually what Mao talks about in his one of his great essays on practice, where he says the transformation in knowledge means that the working class goes from a social class in itself to a class for itself. You know, that the working class realizes that it has an interest in destroying capitalism and destroying the social relations which keep it exploited and repressed. And I think this is a an exciting revelation, but one that's going to pose its own challenges, like you said.
Yeah, and it's just good to see that there are these struggles going on amongst the people to break with the kind of gatekeepers and the sellouts and the revisionists and the compradors.
Right, and all the opportunists.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's kind of what's happened in South Africa over the past, 20, 30 years is you've kind of had the white capitalist replaced with the black capitalist, and there's still a huge kind of national disparity between white settlers and Africans. So there's really been no change to the economic system itself, just kind of a new paint on the surface, so to speak. So and this has really bamboozled a lot of people, both within South Africa and around the world. So it's good to see that these necessary struggles amongst the people, amongst the so-called left, are taking place. We can't just kind of hold hands, sing kumbaya, pretend we're all on the same page and, march to the White House or whatever. And, revolution takes real struggles amongst the people to build a revolutionary movement, not just, elect the Communist Party to a few seats, their token seats, and then, the Social Democratic Party gets most of them, and there's, of course, all of this jazz.
This is a classic example of why the conquest, or what Marx calls the conquest of democracy by the proletariat, cannot take the form of parliamentarism. This is actually something that editor for Anti-Imperialism, Klaus Valia, you mentioned the recent article that was just published today. I actually just published it a couple hours ago. Fantastic article, probably the best work he's had so far. And he deals with this idea of a vanguard party or a party for the working class as a whole. And it's important to understand that this isn't just a necessity in organizational terms, but on political terms. I mean, the working class does not make sense for a revolutionary working class to share power with its exploiters. I mean, this just is a failure. It does not work. It re-entrenches the political supremacy of the exploiting classes, the landed classes, because it gives them legitimacy, or at least the allure of legitimacy to their rule. The working class and the oppressed and exploited peoples must have political dominance. They must have political hegemony if socialism is to be brought forth in any dynamic or any meaningful way.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a document. It's not a documentary. I'm sorry. It's like a dramatization. It's called, what is it? The Fall of Eagles. I'm sure you've probably seen it. It's like where Patrick Stewart plays Lenin, and he has that really.
Right.
He's talking to Trotsky. And he has that really great line where he asks Trotsky, whom is the revolution directed against? And Trotsky answers, the bourgeoisie and its representatives in power. And Lenin says, no, it's not. That's not who the revolutionary struggle against. The revolutionary struggle is against everyone and anyone who stands against the revolution, who is in the way of the revolution. And that really, you just mentioned hegemony, and that really goes to show, that really speaks to the fact that it's not just the state we have to fight. It's this whole host of reactionary forces out there.
Right.
Gromsky talked about the state as like the frontline trench. And behind that, there was like the fortress of civil society, which is kind of raised up in the school of bourgeois ideology, even within third world societies, isn't going to, naturally gravitate, or spontaneously gravitate towards, the revolutionary organization. I mean, it really does take work, struggle, dedication, the professional organizations. And I don't mean like, the NAACP or anything like that, but I mean organizations made of cadre who are dedicated, professional, things of this nature. And it looks like that's what NUMSA is trying to do in South Africa. They're talking about reaching out and trying to build a bigger union, a more revolutionary red union, against the yellow unions controlled by, the ANC and the South African so-called Communist Party. So hopefully that will be a good thing. Moving on to other news, though, and I just want to give everybody a shout-out if people are listening out there. I don't actually know how many people listen to this show, but if people want to call in towards the end of the show and ask Zach or I a few questions, we'd be more than happy to take a call. I think the number is on the radio website, so please do.
Yeah, the number is 1-718-664-6436. It's right on the actual page. If you click on the link where you're listening, you can see the number right at the top.
Awesome. And if you want, yeah, I mean, if you have Zachariah's Facebook, you can hit us with a message. We actually don't do that. Mine's muted, so I probably won't see it. But in any case, we'll move on to a couple other news items really quick. So the big thing in the news is what's going on in Ukraine. Russian.
Right, and actually, if anyone was, I don't know if you were listening, Nick. If anyone was listening, there's actually quite a fiery discussion going on with former Socialist Party candidate Stuart Alexander, who hosts the Socialist Insight, which is a great show, actually. And he was having a few guests on, and they were in quite a fiery discussion over this question of Ukraine and the conflict between NATO influence there and Russian influence. Was quite interesting.
Yeah, what's your take on it?
Well, it's the correct one, of course, Nick. No, but
great to hear.
Just
in serious. All right, Jack, go ahead.
This is this is a very delicate situation, and I mean I've taken some heat even from my position. I know anti-imperialism has, we're not obviously a monolithic website or even a monolithic organization. We all have differing lines on different things. But the line been put forth recently by us is that you can characterize the conflict in the Ukraine as a conflict between inner imperialist rivalry, as in a conflict primarily between Western imperialism embodied in NATO and the European Union, and Russian imperialism in the East, which has as of late taken a more very solidified presence, specifically with the action there in the Crimea, which I guess to my understanding recently is going to be joining Russia fairly soon, which is quite an interesting development.
They had an election for it, which, I don't think we need to really state our opinions on elections or convenient tools for whoever's in power, but nonetheless, I think it's kind of interesting to issue
self-determination
in this case. And the majority of the Crimeans do support Russia and the Russian occupation. But I'm kind of skeptical that the vote was 98% without some sort of intimidation or whatnot.
Minorities. The specific number of 98% is actually what leads me to be very doubtful of the legitimacy of it. And I don't necessarily question the fact that Crimeans would like to resist what appears to be a rising fascism in the Ukraine, specifically with openly fascist members in the new administration. I mean, I don't imagine that as difficult at all. I'm sure Crimeans, especially with many of them being Russian-speaking, desire to stay out of it. I simply would find it hard to believe that Crimeans would so readily accept the domination of their homeland by Russia in a 98% referendum. That just seems bizarre, to say the least.
I guess the only thing is that I don't know if most people feel it's the domination by Russia, so to speak. I mean, especially if you have a very right-wing oriented movement happening in Ukraine, which, and all of that. And it's not like, I mean, to pose it as that domination or not domination. I mean, they're going to be, I don't want to say the choice is between being dominated by Russia or the West via Ukraine, but that seems to be the choice that the people of Crimea face right now. More interesting is the kind of the dynamics driving each imperialist bloc. It seems like almost like Russia is jumping the gun in respect to China. They don't seem to have like the sort of support going forward that they may have thought they would have. So it seems like they're pretty willing to, you know, stop at Crimea. And, of course, the U.S. doesn't want that to happen. It's kind of interesting that, the hollow rhetoric on self-determination as well. You have Ukraine wanting to deny Crimea self-determination. You have, you know, each imperialist bloc wanting to deny the whole region self-determination, essentially.
Right. And unfortunately, and I think this is, if I may speak quite frankly, Nick,
yeah.
and with our listeners, I think this is a failure, in my opinion, of the left, especially within the West, even, to, you know, and I recognize this fact that, you know, our primary duty is to, you know, to deny the success of our own imperialist powers, right? To first and foremost, resist the encroachment of, you know, Western imperialism and so on. However, you know, there's this constant, you know, kind of articulation of Russia's previous actions, or current actions, I should say, as being this kind of emancipatory liberation of Crimea and part of the Ukraine. It's kind of ridiculous, in my opinion, because it's the same kind of attitude that looked upon the, quote, Soviet intervention, quote, intervention in Afghanistan as being this kind of admirable liberation of what was going on there. I mean, certainly when a superpower, you know, an imperialist power first and foremost like Russia uses military force to exert on a sovereign body, I become very leery at that point that any sort of emancipatory relation is going on. I mean, it's hard to imagine that all of a sudden Vladimir Putin has, you know, taken up the line of self-determination for all oppressed nations, and he has now gladly accepted this great revolutionary duty on his behalf to liberate Crimea. It's just kind of ridiculous.
Certainly, and I think that's really important to recognize that the situation isn't good, isn't to recognize that we need to pick one bad choice over the other, Russia or the U.S. But just it makes it possible to recognize that both sides are bad, in my opinion, to some extent. I find it weird that there's this trend that you know, posits Russian society as this very, I mean, it's almost like there's these people in this kind of fantasy world where it's still like 1936 or something like that, or, you know. You know, and
right,
and
like, I mean,
socialist society, Putin and Stalin, like, and that's simply not the case. I mean, Russia is a very kind of modern, capitalist, nepotistic sort of state that doesn't have many redeeming qualities to it. I mean, and I don't mean to come off as anti-Russian. I you know, get along with Russian people quite well.
I think there's a fair amount of nostalgia. You know, there's a fair amount of nostalgia for the idea of a great power challenging Western imperialism, which, I mean, you cannot doubt that the Eastern bloc of imperialism has most certainly challenged the Western bloc, specifically with challenging the European Union. However, I don't think you should replace an actual correct analysis along, you know, with the revolutionary science for nostalgia for, you know, a previous time where, you know, you could look upon favorably on, you know, Soviet or, you know, socialist Chinese intervention on these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Is it a clear example in kind of like the world scene of why it's highly necessary to start building independent institutions of the oppressed, you know, revolutionary institutions today before something like this happens in another, you know, wherever you're at.
Right.
And you're stuck in a situation where it's either like, you're up against between, like, Nazis and neo-Nazis and, like, whichever empire, like, or whichever imperialist bloc. You know, so it's kind of, that's been the situation in Ukraine. It's been all this jockeying over, like, presidential seats and parliamentarism, you know, whether it's Yushchenko or Yanukovych. You know, people have been so obsessed with these sort of parliamentary games that they've really forgotten to build these independent institutions of the left. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have fascists knocking down Lenin statues and taking over your government and, like, all of this stuff. So you know, it really goes to show the necessity of revolutionary organizing today. And just because, you know, the situation in Ukraine kind of sucks, it doesn't mean we need to be down on everything. It just means we need to really get on our game, like get on our shit, and
right.
like really start organizing wherever.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Eastern Europe or the United States or Russia. Yeah.
I mean, you can understand, obviously, in a very much different, qualitatively different social scope. For example, the, you know, specifically not to be, you know, a United States chauvinist constantly talking about U.S. politics, but, you know, living in the United States, it's kind of the center subject at hand. The conflict between, or, you know, minor conflict between the Republican and Democratic Party, where you see a lot of, you know, very leftist organizations with actually, you know, fairly good theory, you know, people that are, have been dedicated to revolutionary, you know, progress, come out and try to support the lowest common denominator within some sort of Democratic Party candidate,
yeah.
you know, what in whatever election. I mean, that is a real problem because it's an endless cycle at that point. I mean, when do we decide
yeah.
to stop supporting the Democrats and actually start building an independent power like you suggested? I mean, we have
Certainly.
To start doing that now. You know, the best time to do it was yesterday, you know. So, I mean, you know,
yeah.
getting on it would be, you know, the best course of action.
Of course. And I think that that sort of that mentality of, you know, I think that's a pretty strong streak of academics is, like, they'll have a pretty decent theory and understanding of how the world works, and they'll turn around and endorse Obama for whatever election
right.
or whoever the stand-in, quote-unquote, for the candidate.
Or comrade Bernie
year.
Sanders, as it
yeah,
appears
or,
it will be
yeah.
in 2016.
Good luck to the Democrats, whoever they choose. But, yeah, I mean, I'll go ahead and call it now. It's going to be the Republicans in 2016. But in any case, yeah, so there's this kind of focus on electoral politics that really does get in the way. And you see this with academics, people who aren't necessarily connected in with the day-to-day struggles of people, is they give up hope in those sort of struggles. And, you know, their only solution is the existing political system, the reform of the existing political
right.
system. I think, for example, Wallerstein has a pretty good articulation of the world economy. But nonetheless, he turns around and endorses Obama, for example, and this is really, on one hand, disappointing. But it's just, you know, it's especially important to know where that sort of thing comes from and to oppose it.
Right. And briefly, we can use Marx even on the issue. When you understand, for example, when you think about a capitalist, he's not going to pay his worker a wage that's going to enable that worker to then become a capitalist and dethrone his own ownership on the means of production, right? Like, the actual nature of wages sort of reproduces this relationship between the exploited and the exploiter. In the same way we can understand the political system, the bourgeoisie is not openly going to supply a route by which they can be dethroned from political power, right? I mean, they're not going to provide the organs by which they might be defeated. I mean, the bourgeois political institutions, these ready-made state apparatuses, as Engels calls them, must be smashed. They must be replaced by working-class institutions of power because these institutions intrinsically to themselves will offer no route by which the proletariat and the oppressed peoples in general can have victory over their oppressors. In fact, they reproduce those relations, and that's very important to understand, and that's the kind of insight, you know, you can get from Marxism. You there, Nick?
It looks like he is.
He might have. I think I just killed him with my theory. I think it was. I think it was a death blow.
Why? I don't know. He's showing up, and it doesn't
yeah.
say that he's dropped. So I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. We can just. I'm sure he'll get back on. What will happen is when he's realized that, he can just recall in a moment if that's the problem.
Can you call me now? Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Serious.
Yeah.
Okay.
There he is.
Okay. Sorry.
I thought
I
killed
my,
you with my theory, dude.
No. You know, you almost did, but it was actually just me hitting my mute button. In any case, and I was talking there. I was like totally had gotten into the next segment, and I was like, anyway. So that had reminded me about, I thought it'd be kind of fun to do this quote of the week thing. Last what we were just talking about kind of reminded me of this. And I haven't shared this quote with you. You may have saw it, but I thought I'd bust it out on people. Let you comment on it. It's from Lenin in 1913, saying, "People have always been the foolish victims of deception and self-deception in politics, and they always will be until they have learned to seek out the interests of some class or another behind all moral, religious, political, and social phrases, declarations, and promises."
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, continue. Nick, did you mute on me again?
I did not. I'm waiting for. I was going to see if you had any kind of response to that or thoughts.
No, I said continue.
Oh, no. I mean, I just thought I'd bust out that quote and see, kind of your thoughts on that.
As I was going to say, I thought you had something to say yourself. But I thought that's really interesting because, there's this, and this is kind of something actually. I had a philosophy midterm not too long ago, being, petty bourgeois ideologue that I am. I had a philosophy midterm where, this idea of an objectivity within science came up. And I think that this is a common theme within politics as well, that there's a certain objectivity to these declarations and to these observations by politicians, but even their analysts and political observers and those sorts of things. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, we should understand that social being, for the most part, determines social consciousness, and we can see the class interests of these declarations from these politicians stemming from serving the objective interests of the capitalist class, of the ruling class. I mean, as Mao said, every idea, every thought has a class character to it. We should not fool ourselves by thinking that there is some false objectivity, some false neutrality we can search for. The truth being that ideology is a primary place for class struggle, and that ultimately a lot of what goes on within the political sphere is class struggle against the working class and against the oppressed people.
Yeah, definitely. And that just goes to show, especially whenever we get into things that pass as left-wing politics, too. I mean, there's a lot of, I suppose, wishful thinking. And a lot of, you mentioned objectivity within politics. So I've noticed there's that kind of trend. I think it's especially strong in the United States. I would hope it's not as big in Europe. But the whole libertarian, whatever phase the United States is going through.
Whatever phase.
Yeah, I mean, it's this kind of infantile sort of ideology. But it really poses itself as this kind of objective framework, when in reality it's a moralistic framework. They state that, the most sensible thing is for the least government interference, when in reality this is, a moral imposition onto the objective world, them trying to institute their own class interest within the world that is, not be messed with by the imperialist state, but still be able to get all the benefits of imperialism.
Yeah, and I mean, libertarianism, is a perfect example. I mean, I think it was actually Clauss, or I cannot remember who it was, but someone had referred to libertarianism as an attempt to turn the clock back on capitalism, being it's a very petty bourgeois ideology, as in, that if we can just return to a competitive free market capitalism, everything will be better. Ignoring that, for one, this is for all intents possible with the current state of monopoly capital. And secondly, who benefits from that besides a very, select strata of small business owners? How does that help, the average person trying to, labor 40, 50 hours a week to provide for themselves and their family? I mean, libertarianism truly offers nothing in that regard.
Go ahead.
No, please go ahead. Finish. I
was just going to say, all it offers is greater liberty for the exploiters,
you know, if I may.
Certainly. And I've kind of always had, like, a canned response to that sort of, you know, we just need to go back to when capitalism was better. And I kind of say, when do you want to go back to? Whenever blacks are being lynched in the South and Mexicans in the Southwest? Do we want to go back to whenever there was slavery or whenever we are waging a genocide against Native Americans? When's your ideal period of capitalist history that you're hoping to return to, this pre-monopoly capitalism that you think is so idyllic? And in reality, it doesn't exist. You know, capitalism has always been based on colonization and the blood and toil of oppressed peoples. You know, so that sort of idyllic capitalism is really, you know, the narrow little picture of bourgeois society, petty bourgeois society and settler society. That is particular to, you know, first world settler colonial countries. But Klaus does a good job of exposing that as a kind of moralistic framework. And I see that within the left as well. I mean, you know, you have the CPUSA with their anti-monopoly capital front, so you have a lot of left-wing forces, not just libertarians saying that, like, oh, we need to go back to pre-monopoly capitals. I don't even know if I've never heard a libertarian that was that sophisticated, really. But I've heard
But I mean, that's essentially what they're trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some social Dems that kind of come off that way. That's like, oh, we need, you know, to return to a better day of capitalism. You know, a lot of mythology with JFK and stuff like that usually wrapped into it. But,
it's definitely a big trend
out there.
To borrow from Zizek, of all people, Slavoj Zizek, Slovenian philosopher and ideologue extraordinaire, he actually gave a fairly good lecture called First as Tragedy, Then as Farce, where he addresses this issue of, he more narrows it down to things like organic subcultures of capitalism and all sorts of things. But essentially it boils down to try to put a human face on capitalism. You know, how can we humanize capitalism? How can we make it more humane, if you will, not to be, you know, species chauvinist in the sense of, you know, humanity, but, you know, how do we make it more egalitarian, to be crude? That's fundamentally flawed, you know, because as he points out, you're using the surplus extracted from the oppressed to then try to mitigate the symptoms of oppression. It's just ridiculous. You cannot humanize these intrinsically unequal material relationships. You know, capitalism, first and foremost, takes part in an unequal material relationship that there are people who have and there are people who do not have, right? And there's nothing, you know, about turning the clock back on capitalism, about free markets, or about a more humane organization of capital that will change that the capitalist system thrives on exploitation. That's how it subsists. And it serves to reproduce that exploitation through maintaining these unequal relationships.
Yeah, and going back to something we talked about earlier, NUMSA in South Africa had called out the ANC for, you know, being more than willing to give people grants and all these, you know, just kind of throw welfare at people, you know, if they jump through a few hoops. But nonetheless, there's this huge unemployment rate, huge disparity in wages between settlers and Africans. You know, so there's so many problems, but nonetheless, you have this situation where there's all this kind of money floating around. Of course, it's stolen wealth from the workers. That you know, it's not like capitalism has all these productive places to invest in anyway. So, I mean, in order to stave off unrest, here, take a grant, you know, do a little bit of community service work or something like that. So, I mean, it's become a really effective tool of this kind of humanizing capitalism. Has become a very effective tool thus far of mitigating some of the subjective revolutionary forces, halting some of the subjective revolutionary forces that would normally oppose capitalism. And I think that is probably going to become a larger feature of our world as it goes on, you know, more surplus being kind of redistributed through the state.
And I mean, that is the root of social democracy. you know. I mean, that is, it's the idea that the capitalist class can maintain power by making some very careful concessions. I mean, but it's ultimately going to fail, right, Nick? I mean, that is our projection as revolutionaries, that these efforts at humanizing capitalism will fail in the same way that efforts at humanizing feudalism failed when the absolute monarchs tried making concessions to rising parliamentary revolutionaries by, you know, allowing parliamentaries to exist, giving, you know, smaller and smaller rights to emerging capitalists at the time. You know, the feudal monarchies of the time, the absolute monarchies tried to hold on to power in that way through making very careful concessions to their opposing class. However, that ultimately fails, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it fails. It definitely staves off the struggle for a while, but who knows how long that will last. And even if it does stave off the struggle, like we discussed earlier, I mean, there's a lot of kind of background issues, ecology, which is general inequality. So it's definitely going to come to a head in one way or another. I mean, it's obviously, I don't have a crystal ball or anything like that, but, you know, class struggle is here. It's not something that, you know, we have to create. It's just a matter of seizing upon it, I suppose, and channeling it and focusing it and amplifying it and then, you know, instigating it, I suppose, in a progressive sort of way that does,
right,
you know, build those independent institutions, whatever they may be. And definitely I saw a little bit of discussion on kind of different forms of that, both food not bombs sort of stuff, you know, community-oriented, you know, how to meet people's needs essentially outside of the state framework,
right,
which is definitely important. You know, get people off of welfare, you know, get people off of being, you know, dependent on the state, so to speak, and then necessarily docile when it comes to struggling against the state. You know, all their, you know, at that point, the highest consciousness you can get is electing the candidate that's going to be more social democratic.
Yeah, and this is something that, and it's for that exact reason, I think, that we hold the Black Panthers in such high regard. You know, specifically, the Black Panther Party had a lot of shortcomings, certainly theoretically and practically. However, they got it right, that you need to have a revolutionary movement be successful. You need dual power, right, what you're talking about. You need independent institutions for people's power if you want that revolutionary movement to be successful, if you want it to have the same dynamic character to it, the same invigoration of the masses. And to continue borrowing from his lordship, Klaus, he stated this perfectly, as in, this is why, at least for a lot of reasons, the far left in the United States has been so unsuccessful, and why you see so much divisiveness and so disconnect to the masses, is that there's no parallel movement, or at least no significant parallel movement in a lot of places towards dual power. It's just these kind of free-floating, abstract revolutionary organizations who are in competition with each other because they're not truly grounded in any development of dual power, any development of any independent institutions to combat the current social order in any meaningful way.
Well, you're talking about dual power, and Klaus had just recently wrote that article on the Vanguard, and that's, you know, definitely a Vanguard party is an institution. Since we're on the show, and since, you know, maybe a lot of people are either skittish towards the term Vanguard because, you know, it does get pretty abused a lot, or because,
unfortunately,
you know, people aren't familiar with it, unfortunately, and you know, deservedly, because unfortunately it gets abused a lot, but then we need to recognize when people are abusing it, and,
yeah,
you know, people are naturally going to be skittish towards the term. But for you, why is, or I guess not necessarily for you, but why would you say that the Vanguard is necessary? What is the Vanguard? What role does it play in the revolutionary movement?
Yeah, and first and foremost, very briefly, yeah, I would like to recognize that there is good reason that people are skittish to the vanguard because of historical failures and very recent failures from organizations who consider themselves, quote-unquote, the vanguard. However, just to name a few reasons why, first and foremost, because the vanguard already exists. As Lenin points out, the vanguard is simply the most advanced elements of the working class and of oppressed peoples. These elements already exist. The Vanguard Party is simply the systematic organization of these elements into an organized force for revolution and for class struggle. That's the first point, is that we need that organization. Because ultimately, some people are going to be advanced in revolutionary theory and others are not. That's just the uneven development of capitalism. Secondly, we need it because in the same way that Marx references, as I mentioned earlier, the conquest of political power, the working people need unity in political action. And this unity in political action can be embodied through the Vanguard Party. And there's this constant confusion that the Vanguard Party symbolizes this kind of elitism, bureaucracy, social, you know, uppityness, to say the least. You know, perhaps uppityness isn't the greatest word, has racist connotations behind it, but kind of just a social elitism that the Vanguard brings. But, you know, people need to understand at the same time that historic examples of the Vanguard Party, specifically when you think of Vanguard preformations such as the Black Panther Party, were entirely composed of oppressed peoples, you know, people directly from the masses, from the most oppressed and exploited groups within the social formation, right? That part of the Vanguard is taking these elements and using them to invigorate the masses, to empower the masses, and so that the masses have, you know, one succinct point of struggle that they can exercise. That the Vanguard Party, first and foremost, is a tool for revolution. It is a tool for the revolutionary subject. That instead of having all of these little separate organizations, unguided and, you know, ununited, that they unite into one solid force, which can very strategically and using scientific analysis determine the best route of action. And historically, Nick, that has been the only way to ensure a successful social revolution. And when you look at revolutionary movements today with any meaningful significance, they are led by vanguard organizations. Think of the Naxalites in India. Think of the New People's Army in the Philippines, and even the Shining Path for a while in Peru. I mean, these were significant revolutionary movements led by a vanguard party that was very intimately connected to the masses in their struggle, and that's what's important.
And you definitely spoke a lot on kind of what is the vanguard and why it's necessary. And I guess the other important question, it seems, is what happens if there isn't that sort of organized vanguard element or that. And I guess I tend to think of it in the same way, you know, the vanguard is kind of like the leading revolutionary element. But within kind of movements of opposition, the revolutionary element isn't always the leading element. So you can have, like, you know, within the U.S. there was the anti-war movement. There's a lot of, you know, reformists and Democratic Party supporters and, you know, all of that mess. And there was, you know, some nominally Marxists and all that stuff. So you can have a situation where you do have, you know, a more advanced section with regards to anti-imperialist revolution that's not necessarily leading, like a present movement against whatever
right.
personality is apparent to
right.
the masses, whatever, you know, ruling personality is easy to target.
Right.
I guess, and then you have these situations, I think the two I'm kind of most familiar with are, you know, most people are familiar with the Zapatistas, but also MINSA is a movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta. Both were kind of, you know, quote-unquote leaderless movements, you know, how they like to fancy themselves. And it seems like they both had not been as successful, and I guess I was just kind of hoping to get your take. What happens
right.
if that vanguard leading organized element isn't present in a kind of movement?
Right. Well, first, specifically in the Zapatistas, when you think of the most successful parts of the Zapatista movement, the new Zapatista movement in the 90s, Those movements, that struggle was very well organized, to be quite exact. And even though it was rather perhaps decentralized from an exterior view, there were still leaders. You know, there was still organization going on. However, more to the point of what happens when there isn't a vanguard party, I mean, you can see this, like what you talked about with the anti-war movement, when you talk about all of, even Occupy, you talk about these spontaneous mass movements, not to demean spontaneous movements. They have a very important role within social transformation. However, if spontaneity is not then guided by an actual conscious, that's very important to understand, a conscious, organized struggle, it is left very open, wide open to opportunism from different factions within that movement. And it's that kind of disunity and that kind of opportunism which is why these movements are defeated, right? Because ultimately, while the Vanguard Party not only gives unity, it also gives discipline. And I don't mean to use discipline in the authoritarian sense of, you know, this kind of commanding bureaucracy, but self-discipline and discipline of all party units and cadre and affiliated organizations towards a central goal, that we're all in this together, we all know what we want, and we're going to work till this gets done. It's that kind of discipline that the Vanguard Party brings that is a critical element to the success of any revolutionary movement. And, you know, without that, you know, as you mentioned, any host of problems can happen, and certainly the most dangerous is opportunism and right opportunism from certain factions who will sell out to reformers.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big problem in Occupy. And it seems like whenever there's not that kind of centralized leadership as the revolutionary movement goes forward, you kind of lose steam, lose sight of goals, or you kind of sell yourself short in terms of goals, and it ends up being a kind of war of attrition against reactionary forces.
Right.
You know, which may have some temporary victories, but not widespread, not systemic,
right,
or the other possibility, it seems like. And this is what happened with Mensa was, you know, they definitely were organized in terms of being able to, you know, lead raids and everything like this to organize as a movement. But without that sort of guiding leadership structure, there wasn't, or that unifying leadership structure, it was really easy for reactionary forces to try to bargain with individual units or individual kind of chain of commands. And eventually they were able to pull a few away from the Mensa coalition, and it basically, you know, really, I don't want to say it collapsed, but it hasn't been the same since. I mean,
right,
in a sense, most of them have sold out since then, except concessions and whatnot.
And one last very quick note on the issue, because I know we're running out of time. But as I mentioned earlier, the Vanguard Party, the organized revolutionary struggle, being primarily a tool for the oppressed people, for the working class, it's a tool. It's also a weapon in the class struggle. So when we think of the capitalist class, they have an entire military infrastructure, an entire army. Why would we deny ourselves an army? And certainly revolutionary movements that have been successful have not. That's why there's a people's army, correct? And in doing so, the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, monopoly capital, has a very, you know, not entirely organized or centralized structure. However, they have a very real ideological and state structure that's present that protects their interests. Why would we deny ourselves the same sort of organizational weapon within the Vanguard Party? The only thing it can do is hurt us by denying ourselves that, that weapon that we can use against them. I mean, the enemy has, if the enemy has an assault rifle, why would we deny ourselves an assault rifle? It simply on an intuitive level doesn't make sense when you think about it within the scope of an active class struggle.
Yeah, and I think that's true to a certain extent. I mean, I've heard people use that justification for like, oh, well, we need, you know, multiple socialist parties that, you know, can contend in the revolutionary struggle, and it's like, you know, maybe in some after the revolution or something like that, and like, you know, after class struggle has kind of died down, and we can kind of like have these multiple parties based on, you know, affirmative beliefs and things like that.
Right.
But it seems rather difficult to kind of, I mean, generally, like, the multi-party system is used to bamboozle people. It's not used to as an instrument to hit people with, necessarily. So, I mean,
correct.
every form of bourgeois rule or bourgeois
I agree.
Military is applicable. And we definitely need to, like, take on, we need to understand what we're up against and kind of modify these.
Good night, guys.
Our own struggle. Good night, Roseanne.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Roseanne, for all the time.
Yes. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you,
Zach. Thank you, Roseanne. Have a great night.